Okay. We'll get started. Very good afternoon, everybody. Yes, wakey wakey, are you still awake? Yes? Yes, you've had lunch? Yes, you've been fulfilled? Yes? Had a couple of sessions already with me, so nice to see you all coming back. Glutton for punishment, I say, but there we go. My third session today. Not many speakers can say that, actually. My third session today is this one. So, cybercrime, the ultimate 2013 survival guide. So, what I've done is I've kind of compiled what I think are the top 10 kind of issues at the moment, and we're going to talk about their mitigations. Again, everything that I'm talking about you can find on my SkyDrive link. I've dumped literally everything there, all my the web pages that I'm looking at, white papers, slides, all the videos that I'm showing, absolutely everything. So all you need to do, just sign up to my Twitter, and yeah, you get access to that. All right. So there's love here, I think. Yes? So I like to give love, especially in the afternoon, because some of you look like you need it. So going to kick off this particular session. If you've not seen me before, then my name is Andy Malone. I'm from the UK, Scotland predominantly, in a place called Stirling, home of William Wallace. And this particular, well, who am I? I'm an MVP, like Marcus and Paula, in enterprise security for 8 years now. I'm also a certified trainer for, God, almost 9 years. Sorry, 19 years. Ooh, that's a long time. So, in this particular session, we're going to talk about the cybercrime top 10. So, what are the kind of the top 10 issues at the moment? You might find a few surprises in here. You may find a few obvious things in here. You may not agree with me, but that's fine. This is my game, and I'll play it any way I want. So, off we go with number 10. So, in at number 10, of course, is A Zombie Will Rise. So if you've not seen Brad Pitt's latest movie, it was filmed in Glasgow. One of what's it called? World War Z. Great movie, by the way. So I'm not talking about zombies here. Of course, I'm talking about botnets. So like zombies, these are WMDs, weapons of mass destruction. And what makes them particularly dangerous is the fact that they're all fully automated. So these tend to manifest themselves not just on PCs, but they're starting to manifest themselves on other types of devices as well, but predominantly PCs, laptops, servers, and so on. Why? Well, because the bad guys basically use your computing power to fund their business, and they do it very well. But these are not old, or not new, rather. They've been around a long time. So, again, you can go in and rent. There are legitimate places where you can go in and you can rent botnet space. So if you don't want to do your business in the cloud, you can do it on a botnet, which is similar. So it gives you the processing kind of power for that. So very much to services to hide, or for hire, rather. Now, you can actually go to Tor Network, and there are a number of vendors, shall we call them, on there that will gladly rent you the space on these. So essentially, what is it? Well, they're a fully automated delivery platform. Predominantly, around 78-79% are used for delivering of spam. And it's actually quite interesting when we talk about spam in the world, spam email. You know, you always ask somebody how much of email is spam. It's obviously in the 90s type percent. The thing about this particular delivery method, though, is it's the automation aspect makes it very difficult to trace and track down and actually stop. How is it delivered? Well, there's a number of delivery mechanisms, one including the drive-by mechanism, the click, you know, the click, you get a piece of malicious malware, you get the deadly link that you click on, and you unfortunately get infested. Another method, of course, is keylogging, you know, dodgy software, USB drives lying around. Again, there's a whole number of methods there. Another thing that they do is the denial of service attack, which I'll talk about shortly. Again, and in terms of problems, this is a huge problem. So this is a problem that we kind of spoke about a few years ago and kind of just brushed it under the carpet, and it seems to have really reared its head again. So these are the types of botnets that are currently out there. Again, some of them you'll recognize, some of them you may not. Again, there's a very long list of them, but these are some of the kind of the big players. Now, it's also interesting to note that the security services and also the technology companies are making great headway in actually shutting down the bots. So if you go to the latest security intelligence report by Microsoft, you'll see that they've made a lot of advances. In fact, this year they shut down a huge botnet network, which is great. Great for us and also great for you guys. So how easy is it to build a botnet or hire a botnet? I mean, you can go online here and you can build your own. All the tools are there. It's all open source stuff. And again, this is, I would encourage you to do this, not to make money, obviously. Well, if you do that, then good for you. But the thing about this is it's a great way to learn the technology, because if you can learn the technology, you can also learn how to defend against it. So once we're infested, once we've got this infection, how do we actually defend ourselves against it? How do we contain this infection? So first of all, you need to know if you're infected, first of all. So these are the kind of things that you should look out for. If your system is slower than usual. Now, I know what you may be thinking. You're thinking, oh, that's just Windows, right? But but your system may be unusually slow. Things like your hard disk drive light might be flashing away quite a lot when you're not doing very much. That's often a telltale sign. Things like files and folders suddenly appear or disappear on your system. Or maybe folders appear that you don't recognize. Maybe software appears in the list of installed software that doesn't have a recognized vendor or no vendor at all. This is often a telltale sign. Things like firewall settings. So the firewall lets you know that, you know, often users just go, yep, that's fine. I'll just click to allow that program through. Also, icons are often hidden. So if you've got an infestation, you won't see an icon. And, you know, how can you find that, what you're infested with? Well, you can use tools, things like sysinternals. Mark Rusinovich, he's got this great set of tools which will help you look at that. Things like unusual error messages, and the bank is normal. You know, you go to a bank account, for example, and it's prompting you for unusual information, information that you know that they should already have. They shouldn't be asking you for stuff. So just kind of unusual types of behavior. So some of the mitigations, some of the things that we can do, you can, obviously, end user education. This is the number one method, probably. Okay, having users know what to look for, having users know what type of links not to click on, the types of attachments. And another really important thing is please make sure that your systems are fully up to date, that you're not using Windows 2000, that you're not using Windows 7 with an old service pack. You must keep your systems updated. And that's actually quite interesting, because if you look at the statistics, the last time I looked, about 48% of Windows users don't update their systems, which is incredible. It's an incredible figure. So things like host-based antivirus software, things like make sure the firewall is switched on. I love network access protection. So NAP, deploy NAP, then you don't need to worry about it. So the idea behind network access protection, if your firewall is down, your antivirus is not updated, it won't let you onto the main network. And you can use NAP in conjunction with other technologies as well, which makes it interesting. So basically, doing nothing is probably your dangerous and it's your worst enemy in this particular technology. There are a number of useful sites that you can go to, and I've basically listed them. There's a whole bunch of sites that I've listed. Primarily, this a great way actually to defend against botnets is, yes, organizations like Microsoft, Google, they all have kind of best practice guides. you know one of the best places to go is the military? Military and security organizations, because they're so compelled to be compliant, they produce really, really good documentation. So again, it's probably something you wouldn't think about, but I do recommend going to it and having a look at that. There's a whole bunch of other sites that I've put on some notes, and I'll provide these to you in links. So that's number nine. Excuse me. Okay, so coming in at, sorry, that number 10. So coming in at number 9 then, a close second, of course, is the distributed denial of service attack, okay? I wanted to put in a picture of a smashed iPhone here, but they told me to take it out, so I thought that was quite a good DDoS attack. So, you know, nothing worse. You buy an ice cream, you trip and you drop the ice cream. Denied. That's the worst thing in the world, isn't it? So how can we, well, first of all, what is a DDoS attack? Well, the thing about DDoS attack, it's quite difficult to defend against it, okay? Now, you can get software out there and actually DDoS somebody very, very easily. That's the thing about it. A lot of this, a lot of the vulnerabilities in the internet were designed in an age when the internet was new. So a lot of it actually attacks the very basics of the internet, so the very the first kind of architecture layer, and the problem with that is, of course, with security, we just continue to build on top of fairly old technology, and this type of attack actually attacks the basics, so it's quite difficult to defend against. So it basically overloads the system. It overloads the system with millions of packets potentially. Of course, the good thing is, for the bad guy, is he can bring down your network, and he can basically charge you money to bring it back up again. So there, for a bank or for a company that absolutely relies on their web technologies, losing internet connectivity can mean the loss of thousands in revenue. So it's very concerning. So this was an attack last year. Of course, CNN, well documented, there was tons of these. So the problem is it dumps so many packets to your network, it just forces the web server down. Now, of course, I'm not just talking about web servers, I'm talking about many different types of servers. Now, you think, okay, that's cool. Most modern software now, I can buy a piece of DDoS software and I can attempt to DDoS you. But the thing about that software is it might not be strong enough, but that's okay. You can go off and you can rent a DDoS attack. So you can pay a little bit of cash if you want to get revenge on somebody. And again, these are services that are running on the Tor network. I'll maybe show you one in a little while. So when you look at the statistics, you can see that in terms of DDoS, the attacks are getting bigger, they're getting stronger, and they're getting more complex. Now, what does that tell you? It either tells me that organized crime is involved here, or some kind of government or state-sponsored crime. So, because we're talking a lot of money to kind of initiate these types of attacks. So we're not just talking about Joe Soap in the street here. Recent attacks include these, Spam House, of course, Bitcoin, WordPress, CNN, the White House, and this is a huge, long, and growing list. So basically, DDoS can attack anybody, anywhere. And again, we need to think about how we can defend against that. So to understand how to defend, you need to understand the types of attacks. So a volumetric attack here essentially overloads the WAN circuit. So again, I'm not talking about a website here. We're talking about potentially corporate infrastructure. And what makes this interesting is the fact that corporate infrastructure is expanding everywhere now. So it's got, whereas before in the old days, we had the, I call it the factory model, you know, where you walk through the gates in the morning and it's basically protected, it's ring-fenced. So that type of environment really doesn't exist anymore because we've got access to our networks in a multitude of devices, 24/7, 365 days a year. So this type of attack is actually quite interesting because it can be initiated anywhere. So other types of attacks, of course, are layer 3 and layer 7 types of attack. So again, whether it's a HTTP GET type request, so it's doing it at the application level, or it's doing it, for example, at the protocol level, they all essentially have the same type of result. So I mentioned that you can get the software, so this is just one particular service that's out there on the Tor network, and this is another one. So this guy, you can email him, and for less than whatever it is, $500, he will take down your enemy's site. Okay? And he's got access. This guy has been noted as bringing down some of the big boys. So again, this is one of the services that's available on the Tor network. So in terms of DDoS software themselves, if you want to have a look at DDoS software, we can basically have a look at this. Okay, so I have got some security tools here. First of all, I'll show you the web pages, I think. Okay. Let's go to here. And we'll do here. Okay, so some of those sites that we have, well, first of all, you've got this one. So this is the low orbit cannon. Oh, sorry. Let's just change. Ah, there we go. Okay, cool. Okay, so we've got the low orbit cannon, that one there, and also you've got DOS HTTP. Okay, now these are legitimate security test tools. So great for defending your website against a potential attack. So again, you can test your website anytime. I can go here and I can say, okay, let's test my website here. So cybercrime securityforum.org. Okay, so now that that website's running, I happen to know that we've actually got a pretty good denial of service attack tool in there, a defense mechanism. But anyway, what I can do is I can basically say, okay, I want to either, do you want to attack a physical host on your network, or do you want to attack a particular website? So again, I will do the website. Let's say get the information. Okay, so once we've got the information here, I can then select the port number, then the amount, the timeout, the settings, and I can basically go off and try and attack that particular website. Now, in this case, we've actually got a service that's protecting that website. So that is not going to bring it down. I could even go a little bit further, and I could run the DOS HTTP attack with it as well. Should have maybe used a shorter domain name here. Again, you can specify what type of user agent that you want. So I'm just using just a standard one. I can specify the volume, so the sockets, the number of sockets that I want to use the attack, whether I want the request to be continuous. And again, I can just verify the UL. So it gives me a little report just to tell me that that URL is okay, and I can then go off and start the flood. Now, obviously, if your website then starts falling over, you then, obviously, you're vulnerable. So you then need to think, okay, how am I going to protect myself from that in that scenario? Now, there are a large number of, for example, cloud vendors that will basically protect you for that. And again, I've in my list of goodies that I'm giving you, I provided a whole list of those vendors and also details on some of the services that these guys are actually offering. So it's definitely worth looking at. So it's worth just playing with this software. Again, anything that I show you today, by the way, if it breaks something, then it's entirely your own fault. So we have no warranties or anything like that with the sessions. Okay, so that's that. So just head back to here. The other thing that I was going to show you is, where are we on? We're on DDoS. Yes. Now, this morning you were, Marcus maybe showed you, excuse the expression, FOCA, did he? So some of you that were in his session this morning, he basically maybe showed you this. Well, this is FOCA's evil twin. This is called, actually, that's the original one. That's a fantastic tool. So it looks for vulnerabilities on your networks, and also you can steal metadata and just make sure that your customer or your vendor that you're working with hasn't got any juicy information on the web that they shouldn't have. So this other one here, this is Evil FOCA. I've got to be careful how I say that. Now, this is a fabulous tool, by the way. So what this particular tool does, it will go off and it will scan the network here. So let's see who's in the room. Okay, give it a little chance. Okay. I think I'm having dodgy internet activity here. Anyway, just to shorten the session, what we've got, this is a fabulous testing tool. So if you're involved in pen testing, I thoroughly recommend this tool. So you can perform, for example, man-in-the-middle attacks, whether they be IPv4 or IPv6, denial of service attacks. You can do DNS hijacking. Again, there are a whole bunch of potential nasty tools that you can use here, again, for security purposes. So again, it's worth just being familiar with that tool. Now, in terms of finding vulnerabilities, this is also a good tool as well. This is called NetSparker. And NetSparker, you can see I can select my website here, cybercrimesecurityforum.org. I can basically say, what type of test do I want to do? Again, with all of these tools, you'll find that there is a free version and also there's the full kind of paid version. Now, the fact that I'm Scott, I never pay for anything, so... what we've got here, you've got a number of scan settings, so it can scan your websites for potential vulnerabilities here. Also, it's got things like authentication, so what type of authentication is the user using, and again, you can target it, and it will also run some pretty good reports as well. So I can go off and I can essentially start that scan, and it gives you a pretty good report back saying exactly what it's found. You can customize all of this. So you can see it tells you what's involved in the scan. If there's any kind of vulnerabilities listed under here or resources that maybe look a little bit suspect, it will come out and it will say, hey, you know, you need to do something about this. So it does lots of different types of tests. You can specify, let me zoom in for you there. So you can do a SQL injection test, things like cross-site scripting type attack. So again, this is not a brand new tool. It's been around a little while, but it's maybe a good opportunity to dust this one off. So this is a nice tool. This is the NetSparker tool. And again, I'm providing that, including in my downloads. So you've got access to that. Just close that down. What was the other thing that I was going to show you? Yeah, okay, so those were the main tools there that I was going to show you. So there's a number of other websites that you can also use. Okay, so mitigation. So how do you mitigate against a very difficult attack? Well, at the ground level, one of the things that you can do is you can do some work on your DNS servers. So predominantly you want to disable recursion in DNS, or you at least want to limit it to authenticated servers. So this was a real issue, if you remember back in the days of Windows 2000. You also want to limit the number of responses on named servers as well. You can limit the number of requests there. Definitely think about implementing an intrusion detection system, but I would go probably one further there. I would probably say an intrusion prevention system, because an intrusion prevention system, the difference between them is that IDS is basically a little bit like an antivirus. It will just, you've got to keep the engines up to date, and it will just test your system against the test that it's got in the database. Whereas an IPS, intrusion prevention system, it's got kind of intelligent heuristics built into it. So it's intelligent. And it will basically say, hang on a minute, that traffic does not look right. That doesn't look like HTTP traffic. The packets that are coming through don't look right. So I would probably recommend an IPS. And we're not talking a lot of money here, folks. I mean, this stuff is really relatively inexpensive. And in fact, you can actually get free ones as well. Definitely have some kind of DDoS plan. So whether you've got an ISP or whether you're hosting your website yourself, you definitely want to have some kind of DDoS plan. And just if they're hosting your website, check what kind of systems that they've got in place to protect you here. Other things that we've got, utilize the host DDoS settings. Ensure that you've got sufficient bandwidth for the website. So, I mean, of course, we're talking a denial of service attack. You know, you might just have, for example, the Olympic Games running on one server. Well, of course that's going to fall over because you just don't have the bandwidth. So if you think that you're going to be involved in a project like that, again, make sure that you've got an appropriate server farm, server response. It's a bit like going through the gates at a football ground, for example. Good tip there, keep your DNS TTL settings low. So don't keep TTL settings, time to live settings, very long, because if you keep them a long time, that's basically hogging the network, and you're basically keeping those records alive, and that could cause issues. And definitely have a plan. So definitely have a plan. Okay. So in at number eight, I suppose, you know, we're at a Microsoft conference. And last year we did a security panel on cloud security. Now, actually, it was 2 years ago we did a session on cloud security. And at that point, I must confess, like Marcus and Paula, I was a bit skeptical about security in the cloud. Now, this is taking the whole kind of Ed Snowden thing separate, by the way. I mean, if you worry all about that, then you'll never do any business anywhere. But the question is, just how safe is my stuff in the cloud? Well, the question is really, how safe is the stuff on that dusty box that you've got under your desk in the office? Are you really any safer than having your data here or having your data in the cloud? I mean, you've got a number of benefits. The fact that it's backed up, that the systems are updated, there's a whole bunch of stuff there. So, however, when you're sourcing a cloud provider, and again, I'm not endorsing any particular company here, but when you source a cloud provider, the problem with the cloud is that there are two models for cloud. There's the paid-for solution, like Office 365 or Amazon or Google. And then there's the free stuff. So there's the free stuff like Facebook and Twitter and all of those types of companies. And they make their money with marketing and advertising. Instagram is a perfect example. And also Facebook as well. So if you post anything on Instagram, if you post any like movies, pictures, anything like that, if you put anything on those websites, they own that. Okay, so they have sole proprietary rights to distribute, copy, duplicate, use for advertising, anything. So if you've got kids and you put your kids' pictures in Instagram, don't be surprised if you're in London one day and you see them on the side of a bus. Seriously, it is that plain and simple. So know what you're signing up to. Now, all these free services are great. They're great. We get free stuff. Now, Microsoft, they have their SkyDrive, so we can sign up for SkyDrive. Absolutely awesome. Sign up for a SkyDrive, get 25 gig of storage, whatever it is, and your data's there. But if you look at the terms and conditions, they make absolutely no warranties to back up your data. They make no guarantees to do that. So how do they get around that? They give you a desktop tool that allows you to synchronize your files. Okay? That's basically how they get around it. Now, if you're then going for a paid solution, you can then start looking at, let's say, SkyDrive Pro. So SkyDrive Pro is part of Microsoft Office 365. And with that type of service, you do get guarantees. You are getting a money-back guarantee with them. They do guarantee not to sell on your data. They do guarantee the privacy. So again, it's all what you sign up for. And the thing about it is you need to read the print. It's very, very easy just to click buy a EULA and not read it. So ignorance goes a big way. Now, I've spoken with a few academics in the audience today. And academia is terrible for this. Because the problem with public services and academia is it's very disjointed. So there's lots of different departments. And one department will go and shove something in the cloud. Another department will create a SharePoint site. And basically, the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. And that's when you get the security issues. So if you're going to start working in the cloud, you need to kind of communicate together. Ambiguity as well. Agreeing to contracts where you have no idea what you're signing away for. Again, trespassing as well. So putting data in the cloud potentially is illegal in some countries. Okay, so you need to check that out. Are you allowed to put data in the cloud? Now, I mean, I'm doing a couple of Office 365 sessions this week. This is one of the topics that I do. And I'm always asked about security in the cloud. And the thing that I say about security in the cloud is, A, well, really, you're no less safe than having it physically on a local machine here. And I would physically say you're actually potentially more secure. But it's really all about compliance, isn't it? So Microsoft, like many other vendors, have been working hard to get this word compliance ingrained. Because what does compliance mean? Compliance means that big customers will sign up to it. So if you're ISO 27001, great, you're compliant. Also, another issue with clouds as well is the disorder aspect. You just tend to throw the stuff in there. There's no order to it. And again, complacent as well. So then they don't really understand what they're signing up for. So irrespective of the vendor, make sure that you read the T's and C's, I would say. Now, of course, is it, the difference between the paid-for solution and the free solution is that with the paid-for solution, you get that all-important SLA, service level agreement. And that service level agreement basically says, hey, we guarantee that our service is going to be up 99.9x% of the time. Okay? So if it happens to go down, then you'll get some kind of financial reward there. Now, the thing about this is they can't give 100%. No company can give 100%. You just couldn't do that. Because there are lots and lots of different factors which are beyond that company's control, for example. So when we talk about mitigations, I would say, as a business, do not rely on free stuff. Okay, free stuff normally means that, especially if it's sensitive data, you're having a problem. And I know that there's many small businesses out there, and they often say to me, why the hell do I need to go to Office 365 when I've got a free SkyDrive here? That's the reason. Okay? Because you've got no comeback legally. Definitely try before you buy. Make sure that you back up your data and all these things here. I won't go into all of those. So interestingly enough, when we talk about 365, this is quite a useful list. This talks about how Microsoft are remaining compliant. So all email, all databases are stored in the data center on BitLocker encrypted disks. Okay, so these use AES 256 encryption. Things like the disks on the mailbox servers, the log files, the transaction logs, all of those are also encrypted as well. The OS disks are encrypted. Now, the one thing that's not encrypted, as you'll notice here, is things like SharePoint data. So if you've got document libraries here, your data is not encrypted. Now, how do you get around that? How can I mitigate that? Well, you could sign up for things like rights management services. It does a pretty good job. So rights management services, basically, yes, you can download my slide decks, but when you try and print them, it won't let you print them. If you try and copy them, it won't let you copy them, for example. That's the kind of things that you can do with rights management. Now, in terms of encryption, you could use local encryption tools. So I'm thinking of a free one, AES Encrypt, TrueCrypt, for example. All of these tools, you can encrypt your documents, and you can then store them in the cloud. Perfect solution. Or you can use a cloud solution. There are a number of cloud solutions out there. So again, it's important knowing what your cloud vendor is actually doing in terms of protecting your data. So when we talk about, this is a Microsoft conference, so I've got to do at least one Microsoft demo, right? So basically what we've got here is, I will just close that down. So this is Office 365. And what we've got in Office 365, I've got some users here. And this is really just to show you how Microsoft is actually being compliant. So I'm going to go to my Exchange settings. And in my Exchange settings here, I've just got one email at the moment. You can see that I've got a number of tabs. I've got the Protection tab, and I've also got the Mail Flow tab. Public folders, that's not public folders as you used to know it in Exchange, by the way. So if I go into my Protection tab, you can see that we've got a whole bunch of new stuff here. Now, this is the artist formerly known as Foppy, for from Online Protection for Exchange. And that was a separate system. So now what we have in this wave of Exchange is the capability to manage everything from one kind of system. So what we have here is you've got malware filters, you've got a connection filter that you can set in, you can set a content filter, so what kind of content are you going to allow for your users, how do you want to control outbound spam, and also you've got a quarantine area here as well. You can also manage how mail flows in and out of an organization. So you've got things like inbound and outbound connectors. You can produce really nice delivery reports. You can do things like message tracking or tracing, as it's now known. And you can actually, as a business, as an organization, you can say, hey, I'm only going to accept mail from accepted domains. And also you've got connection settings there as well. If I go into compliance management, you can do things like in-place e-discovery. So one of the loves that I have is forensics. And up until now, well, and certainly recently, you could never successfully do a forensic investigation on a cloud vendor. You needed to call the vendor and say, hey, we need to, you know, you need a warrant for that and blah, 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 blah. And you could never really do that. So now what we do is we now have this capability to do e-discovery and searching. And this is very, very useful for compliance purposes. So other things that you can also place mailboxes on hold. So if you've got Peter here and Peter's maybe been downloading some dodgy content, maybe for HR reasons, maybe for legal reasons, you need to place that account on legal hold. You can control that now. You manage that, not Microsoft. The other thing that we've got is also pretty intense auditing features here as well. So you can run different types of audit reports. So whether it's administrator or non-administrator reports, whether you want to produce in-hold reports, you can use all of these. Other things that we've got, data loss prevention. Okay, so if I send emails out, what you can do here, DLP, there may be types of data that you don't want leaving your company. So things like don't put credit card numbers in emails. Yes? So what it does is when you send emails out or documents outside your company, it basically tests that and it says, hang on a minute, that looks like a credit card number. I can't send that. That's an example how you can do a DLP policy. Other things that we've got as well, retention policies. So again, here in the European Union, we have the Blue Harbor, Safe Harbor Act, and basically that means, you know, for legal reasons, we may need to keep tax records for X amount of years. So this now means that users can right-click on a particular message that's coming in, a particular attachment in SharePoint, and they can save that with what we call a retention policy. And you can set those retention tags up here. And you can see that there's a whole bunch of kind of pre-populated retention tags here. But again, you can actually create those yourselves. Finally, you've also got those journaling rules. So you can see that this is just an example. This product actually has come on a real long way. I started teaching Office 365, the first wave, a couple of years ago. And you had nothing like this in there. You had to go out and buy kind of third-party stuff here. So it's really nice to see that coming back. I mentioned encryption in the cloud. This is a nice feature for home users. So this is a CloudFogger. Free service, you can go in and you can encrypt the data before it goes into the cloud. And again, it's pretty strong, so if you've got SkyDrive, Dropbox, whatever, it can take full advantage of that. Again, it's got a couple of different services. There's a paid-for solution. There's also kind of a limited free version with it, but definitely worth a look. For corporate customers, there is this tool. This is called Cypher Cloud. And again, it works a little bit like Exchange Online Protection. It basically catches it before it gets into the cloud. And essentially, it ciphers up your data. It encrypts your data before it's actually stored it on the Microsoft data centers. So again, I've given a number of different technologies. You can also get this hardware here as well. And in fact, there's probably a number of vendors out there that do that. So again, I've put in a couple of documents in there for you. And again, these will all be available in my notes a little bit later. So that is just a little bit of how Microsoft are ensuring security and compliance in the cloud. So now we come to number 7. And number 7 is essentially the rise of the hacktivist. And, well, you know the hacktivist, Anonymous, yes?
Your secrets keep me peaceful. Your lies keep me safe. You are satisfied. forget.
So, the rise of the hacktivist. Spoken a little bit about this morning. Hacktivists are anybody. There's maybe some of you in the room, okay? This is nothing new. You're just using a different platform to kind of work with this. So hacktivism is basically standing up. It's generally not money motivated. What we're talking about here is we're talking about generally not religious. It's really standing up for what's right. Standing up for something that you believe in. The problem with groups like Anonymous and Lutsec, although, you know, some people say, are they bad guys, are they good guys? Plausible deniability is a real problem with this. So anybody can be anonymous. Anybody could perform an attack. Anybody can create one of those videos and call themselves anonymous. So what it originally stood for, unfortunately, has been watered down because they're doing malicious attacks. So, and at what point does a hacktivist become really quite dangerous? So, a hacktivist, what's the tipping point that a hacktivist can become a terrorist or a cyber terrorist? So, the thing about this particular danger, this particular cyber criminal, is that they're very, very unpredictable. And there's no way to kind of spot somebody. So, you stick a mask on and you're anonymous. Again, Lutsec are another kind of breakaway group. So these are not new groups. They've been around for over 10 years. Started on the 4chan forums. Again, the principles, though, very noble principles are they are, to work together, to present a unified face, honesty and openness, freedom from oppression, all good, noble ideas. But unfortunately, the dangers of being anonymous, as I said, is that often it's easily targeted, for example, by third-party agencies, government agencies, law enforcement, script kiddies, anybody, really. Known members are monitored and brought to justice. So law enforcement, again, remember, as good as you think you are, law enforcement are definitely one step ahead, especially with in lights of the Ed Snowden case. Plausible deniability. So this was the case where Anonymous so-called hacked the a number of North Korean websites. Now, it makes me kind of think, okay, would Anonymous really have the resources to do that? And the chances are it's probably some kind of state-sponsored type of attack. Again, how do they normally communicate? Normally on chat boards like this, underground boards, typically on underground types of websites. And at what point does that activist or hacktivist become the fanatic? As I mentioned earlier, there's that kind of just that tipping point where you believe in something and it's just that step forward that turns you. Okay? And again, psychologically, it's a specific type of psychological profile that will actually do that. So, in we come in at number six. So, we've had a few. Let's go to number six. So, you can't... I love this slide, by the way. Trust. Security is all about trust. Everything we do in security is about trust. So we go onto websites, and just because it's got an SSL logo, we trust it. We trust our bank. We trust our government. Everything that we do is essentially the trust model. So, of course, we're educated people, many of us. We go to websites. We can see that we've got a golden padlock. We assume that this is trustworthy. We're currently in the third wave of SSL certificates. Why? Because the other two waves have been hacked. So anything that can be, you know, if you get a copy of an authentic digital certificate, for example, the Stuxnet virus, okay, we know that somebody obtained the official real certificates for that. And that would have been very, very hard to do unless it was state-sponsored. But we won't go there. So the trust dilemma is, how do we provide individuals and organizations with that confidence, with that level of trust? We need to basically, I think as security professionals, we need to at some point put this trust aside. Mitigation, again, it's all down to user education, as we mentioned. So educate your users, train staff, customers to look for HTTPS. Testing, test your sites, and ensure staff know what to do in kind of bogus situations. So again, multi-factor authentication. I'm developing a session for next year's Tech Ed. The password is dead. What's next? So I honestly believe passwords are definitely gone. We need to move on. Passwords are 30 years old. Okay, we need to move beyond this type of technology. So testing tools, of course, SSL testing. There's a few things that you can do. Actually, there's a few tools that you can do. If I go to this particular, let's have a look what we've got here. This is always SSL lab, so you can test your SSL connectivity here, and it will tell you if there's any particular issues. Also, a number of vendors do this. This is a great site, by the way, serversniff.net. It can test SSL certificates. It can do an SSL check. But there's also a multitude of other services and tools that are here as well. So if you learn only one website today, I would say serversniff.net is great. If you're concerned about vulnerabilities, sign up to the Shodan vulnerability systems. So basically, these show you all the current or known vulnerabilities that are out there at the moment. So you maybe have read about the webcam vulnerability and what this does. You can put an address here, you can test it, and it will basically test the webcams in your organization. It will show you a list of open webcams. This could also potentially be a malicious tool as well, so use this carefully, I would say. So as well as websites, there is other things that we can also use. I showed you this one. This is a nice tool. This is a tool called Site Digger. Again, you can put in a domain here. So again, I will put in... And I can go off. I need to basically say what type of entity do I want to test for. So I can test for things like known vulnerabilities, files containing potentially juicy information. Very, very useful for pen testing, by the way, this tool. Other things that we've got here as well, things like any kind of privacy-related issues. I would maybe... have a look at that. And off it goes, and it will run a number of scans on that particular site. So on the right-hand side, if there were any kind of issues there, it would bring those up, and you can then go in and you can delve deeper into those potential issues. Okay, so that is a little tool called Site Digger. I mentioned Perturva. Earlier, and I gave the example of searching for email addresses. So I'll just run that one again. So this is probably one of the greatest information gathering tools out there at the moment. And you can basically run what we call transforms. And you can basically find absolutely anything about anybody. So I can go in here. For example, if I wanted to find all the email addresses for this organization, off it will go, and it will actually, this will just keep going and keep going and keep going and basically strip out every email address in that organization. I can then save that to an Excel spreadsheet and I use it as a spam. But it can also do much more things as well. So again, there are a number of things like pen testing modules in here. Again, there's two versions of this. Quite expensive product, but the community edition is very good. Again, I've included it with my software on my SkyDrive for you guys. One last tool that I'd like to bring up. I'll just close down some of these. So this is my Office 365 account. And what I'm going to do is I'm just going to start a little tool called Fiddler. Fiddler is a great analysis tool. And also it can actually perform a friendly kind of man-in-the-middle SSL attack. So I can log into my website here. I've forgotten my user account. Old age. I'll just use this one. Here's one I made earlier. Okay, so you can see here what's happening is it's going into SSL mode. And essentially what it's doing, it's analyzing the traffic, and we now have access to this tunnel here. So you can see here, HTTPS decryption has actually been disabled. But I can go in here and I can actually say, hey, I want to actually be a man in the middle here and go ahead and use the Fiddler tool to actually do this. So what it does, it basically sets up a certificate in the middle, and it now allows me to go in and decrypt that SSL traffic. That is a great testing tool, but also a particularly scary tool as well. Okay, so this is a really nice feature. Again, it also, you can really have a look in depth exactly what the traffic is doing. So again, if there's traffic coming in that doesn't look quite right, you can use this as a really good analysis tool. Okay, so that's Fiddler. Okay, so in at number 5, we can't do a session without talking about organized crime and state-sponsored crime. It's definitely up there within the high top 10. So first of all, basic cybercrime organizations, normally gang-controlled. They're very, very fluid. Normally, as part of gangs, they have a breakaway cyber gang. So cyber gangs essentially form for specific projects. So if they're going to do credit card fraud, Bitcoin fraud, something like that, they're going to come together. Typically rife with amateurs, so lots and lots of script kiddies. And normally they're just hired for the particular project and they're paid to go. Okay. Again, the problem with these guys is they're not overly skilled, so they tend to get, these are the first guys that tend to get caught. On the other hand, the advanced gangs are really quite clever, and they do have a lot of resources, and they have dedicated developers that work with them. Again, financially motivated, and they've got the muscle, and they've got the money for some of these larger projects. They tend to recruit hackers through chat rooms, through boards, and also conferences as well, so black hat, places like that. So if you want to make a bit of extra cash, there you go, there's a way to go. So when we talk about state-sponsored crime, this is Jonathan Evans. He's the current head of MI5 in the UK. So state-sponsored cybercrime is now taking place on an industrial scale, absolutely huge on an industrial scale. So how do we defend ourselves against this? Well, the problem is these attacks are professionally delivered, And professionally, I mean, they have a lot of money in there. And often APT attacks, advanced persistent threat types of attacks, they can lie dormant for a long time. So unless you're keeping your systems up to date, unless you are actively and securely proactive, these things can be very, very difficult to find. Good tip, by the way, just at the bottom of there, think about DNSSEC. So implement DNSSEC on your DNS servers. Again, encryption, encryption, encryption seems to be the way here. So following on from that, of course, is cyber warfare. Again, my friend at NATO says, I shouldn't call it cyber warfare. They don't want to call it that. It's got a very negative impact, that kind of word. But whatever you want to call it, state-sponsored crime, whether it's state-sponsored or whether it's, the Stuxnet issue. I'm sure you're all aware of that. You all read about that. There's a big argument to say that, hey, by actually performing that attack, it saved thousands of lives. And they're potentially right. So rather than sending, obviously, troops in to take down a nuclear power station, they basically tried the IT approach. So, at the moment, military are training and they're investing an awful lot of money in cyber troops. So, again, MI5 in the UK and MI6, along with the National Security Agency and the US military, are spending and investing millions in training their troops. Basically, the types of tools that they use, of course, are state-sponsored malware. So whether they're trying to perform a denial-of-service attack, whether they're trying to over-enrich uranium, again, it's naive to think that this is not happening in the world. So typically politically motivated. So cyber warfare is definitely politically motivated. Money doesn't really have anything to do with it. They can include things like espionage. They can include things like sabotage. More frequently, it tends to be sabotage or denial of service attacks. But again, in my materials that I'm providing you, I've got a whole set of documents on this area, which makes interesting reading. Now, possible attack scenarios. So when we take a look at this particular slide, why have I highlighted the top four in red? Can anybody shout out why? Sorry? Yeah, okay. So basically, these four things could be life-threatening. Okay? So the power grid goes down. If you can imagine, the power grid in Madrid goes down. All the air conditioning goes down. If it's in a hospital, that could be potentially life-threatening. Now, it's interesting to note that the various military organizations worldwide, including China, Russia, the US, and the UK, have basically agreed, they have a gentleman's agreement, not to attack medical. Okay, so the idea is that they wouldn't attack hospitals. Now, whether they keep to that, who knows? Things like internet and communications, of course, and typically that type of denial of service attack, think Syria, think Egypt. Typically, when you have some kind of military action, it's preceded by some kind of cyber attack. Water, food pollution, financial infrastructure, cell phone jamming, GPS disruption, all of these are examples of potential cyber attack scenarios. Mitigation, how do you mitigate against that? You can't. There's nothing that you or I can physically do about that. There are preventative methods that we can use. But as I said this morning in the last session, if they want you, they will get you. There's not really much we can do at our level. So, in at number three in our countdown, a game of phones. Okay, so, of course, the attack platforms changed. Yesterday in the security panel, we spoke about the different types of platforms. And, of course, you're aware that Android has had a lot of bad press. There's lots of malware on Android. Well, in its defense, it is free. and again, it currently holds a huge slice of the market. So when we look at the number of attacks over the recent years, yes, the number of attacks have gone up. But at the same time, you can see that the actual platform itself, the Android platform, to the annoyance of Microsoft, is still number one worldwide. Now, it's interesting that when we talk about malware and antivirus attacks, if I showed you slides of operating systems, this might look like Microsoft Windows as opposed to Linux and some of the other systems. And this might show you the number of attacks on the Windows platform. It's because it's the most popular platform. Now, why are some of the reasons why these phones are attacked? Typically, this, you want free stuff. You don't want to pay for it. You want to go to the Pirate Bay and download your free movies and your free software. And that's fine. If you're prepared, you can jailbreak your phone if you're prepared for the consequences. Okay? So the consequences are that you're going to get hit with potential nasty things. So mitigations, don't jailbreak the phone. It's amazing how many people don't use a PIN number, actually, on a phone. Install antivirus software. Hey, I've got an Apple. I don't need antivirus software. Everybody should have antivirus software on their phone. Again, it might not be perfect, but at least it's just another hoop that the bad guy is going to have to basically crawl through. And again, there's no such thing as a free lunch, so definitely remember that. So in terms of each of the different vendors, things like the Microsoft Exchange platform is pretty good because if your phone's stolen, it can do things like remote wipe, as does BlackBerry, as does Apple now as well. You've also got tracing, and on the subject of tracing, this was an interesting story. The woman that stole a Windows phone, she actually accidentally took a picture of herself and it sent it to the guy's email. So we now know who stole her phone, the guy's phone. I thought that was quite funny. Okay, so in at number two is very concerning. I've mentioned it today, the rise of the dark web. The dark side of the internet is a really huge worrying trend. It represents, some people actually say that the dark web can be three times the size of the internet. We're talking thousands of illegal websites and chat boards and chat rooms. Okay? Normally these guys are providing services, features, hosting services for weapons, drugs, prostitution, and even modern slavery. It uses a stealth IP addressing model, which means that every time you log in, you can get a different IP address. And also the sites have seen a massive growth over the years because we like this idea of being anonymous. We don't want to be tracked by the government, so we have an anonymous website. So the problems, and incidentally, the dark net or the dark web, it's not just websites, it's FTP sites, it's email, it's a whole series, a whole other side of the internet. So kind of websites like this, 4chan of course has been around. This is one of the organizations that started with Anonymous. You know, these sites are on normal websites, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about sites like this, the Silk Road, where you can go and you can basically buy drugs, guns, pretty much anything. And the thing about these websites is they're very clever. They have systems which dynamically change the IP address every single day. So they go different hostings, very, very difficult to actually close down. The hidden wiki is often thought of as the doorway into these websites. So again, as I mentioned this morning, if you're going to go forward with these, be very, very careful here. This will take you into a very dark place. You can buy guns, you can buy drugs, anything in here. And these are serious players, okay, as you can see. So this is just one example of an ad that was on one of the boards. What I'm going to provide for you is, I'm not going to do the demo actually because I'm kind of running out of time. But what I will do to compensate you, I'm basically providing all of these tools here. I've got a number of documents, including that white paper. So if you want, I've basically done a whole bunch of research on the dark web, and I've written some white papers, and there's lots of lists of useful websites. There's some useful websites if you're law enforcement people as well. Then there's some interesting sites that you should go and have a look at. And if you want to chat with me afterwards, I'd be interested to talk with you about this. So this is a very useful white paper. The demo that I was going to do, I've cammed it, and I'm storing it as part of my resources, so you can go in and you can download it, so you're not going to miss the demo, okay? Number one. So my final number one is, of course, the humble human being, okay? We're only human, and all of this technology would be nothing without the human being. So Ed, God bless you, but is he right, is he wrong? That's an argument for another time. The fact is that often in many, many cases, if we know that our colleague is up to no good, if we know or we suspect that somebody is a malicious insider, we don't want to believe it because we trust them. So again, we need to lift ourselves out of that. We need not to be afraid to kind of step forward, and don't be intimidated by somebody that would coerce us into one of these kind of acts. Ultimately, don't be too social either. Again, this goes down to user education. It's a well-known reality that you're always going to get one rotten apple in a bunch. So again, I did the session on the inside man threat this morning, and again, I put tons of resources into this particular topic. So hopefully you can go back and you can look at all of these sessions. So, mitigation. Develop sound HR policies. And I don't just mean policies for hiring somebody, but policies for making sure that the person progresses, that they're content, that they're happy in their job, that they feel challenged. Okay, full and ongoing background checks. Check their social networking sites as well. That can often be a good indicator. Things like full resume and reference checking. Things like have a good, solid development program. These are really good mitigation techniques. Okay. I mentioned yesterday that Newcastle Police had a problem with bicycle thefts in the city. So it was basically epidemic levels. I don't know why it was Newcastle. For some reason, it was Newcastle. And what they did is they stuck these posters up, and it reduced within 6 months. It reduced huge number of thefts. So again, it's not the actual security, but it's often the idea of being secure. Okay?
Hello, citizens of the world.
Greetings. We are not anonymous. We represent the law enforcement community. It has come to our attention that many of you consider yourselves to be above the law and assume that we simply sit by and watch, doing nothing while you steal movies, music, and software from pirate websites. You may even be involved with hacking, drugs, money laundering, or worse. It does not matter to us. Please do not be fooled by our quiet inaction. Every person has a digital footprint, And this digital footprint will be your Achilles heel. So while you and your friends continue to exploit these so-called anonymous resources, remember this. We are watching. And we are waiting. And when the time is right, we will not forgive. And we will not forget.
Hold it. Run that back.
Wait a minute. Go right. There, freeze that.
Full screen. Okay, freeze that.
Tighten up. Vector in on that guy by the back of
you. Zoom in right here at the spot.
With the right equipment, the image can be enlarged and sharpened.
What's that?
It's an enhancement program.
Can you clear that up, any?
I don't know. Let's enhance it.
Enhance section A6.
Enhance the detail and...
I think there's nothing enhanced for this entire screen.
Enhance the reflection in her eye. Let's run this through video enhancement.
Vector, can you enhance this?
Hang on.
Working on this reflection.
Someone's reflection.
Reflection.
There's a reflection of the man's face.
A reflection.
There's a reflection.
Zoom in on the mirror.
You can see a reflection. Can you enhance the image from here?
Can you enhance it right here?
Can you enhance it?
Can you enhance it?
Can we enhance this?
Can you enhance it?
Hold on a second, I'll enhance it.
Zoom in on the door.
Times 10.
Zoom.
Move it. More.
Wait, stop.
Stop. Pause it.
Rotate at 75 degrees around the vertical place.
Stop. Go back to the part about the door again.
Got an image enhancer that can fit that?
We can use the producer method to see into the window.
My software is slave the on.
The eigenvalue was off.
With the right combination of algorithm.
He's taken illumination algorithms to the next level and I can use them to enhance this photograph.
Lock on and enlarge the z-axis.
Enhance.
Freeze and enhance.
Okay, so there you have it. The top 10 current cyber threats, and hopefully a mitigation. They may not be perfect for you, but I hope that you've enjoyed the list. Just a reminder, you can get everything that I've spoke about just by simply signing up to my Twitter account. My SkyDrive's there. I've piled everything there for you. I really appreciate you coming along. Thank you so much. I'm Andy Malone. Thank you.